Up next on Think, the biggest surprise of one black woman's embrace of vegan eating, the long history of people like her who had already blazed that trail. We'll spend this hour with culture writer Amira Mercer, who cut meat and dairy out of her diet starting 4 years ago, and at first worried that choice disconnected her from the food traditions of her ancestors. But Mercer's research found a long history of plant-based eating as a radical act that continues to this day, when Black Americans are the fastest-growing demographic among vegan eaters. Our conversation starts after a short break. Culturally shaped choices we make, our decisions about what to eat are among the most fundamental. Our preferences begin to form based on foods our mothers eat while they're pregnant. And once we're born, our palates develop in response to the foods around us and the people who nurture us with those foods. So if you've grown up to eat very differently than your family, are you somehow walking away from your own history? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. When Amira Mercer was growing up in Newark, New Jersey, in a family that came north in the Great Migration, her favorite meals contained meat, generously seasoned pork chops, fried chicken, wings, and ribs, and all the delicious sides to go with them. Meat dishes were not just part of meals in her family, but part of tradition and history, food for the soul as well as the body. So when Mercer started moving away from all that meat and eventually stopped eating anything that came from animals, she wondered at first if these choices she made for the good of her body would somehow cost her her spirit. But she's learned some pretty remarkable things since then. Not only are Black vegans the fastest growing segment of the vegan movement in the U.S., there is a long and rich history of plant-based diets with roots in Africa. Amira Mercer is a culture writer and editor and founder of a wellness guide for Black women called Other Sons. Her recent article for Eater is called A Homecoming. Amira, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much.
So growing up, you ate meat every day, every meal. How often was meat on the table?
Every day, every meal. Yeah, for sure.
And the idea was that people need meat to be healthy, right? Talk about your mom trying to sort of pass on her education about nutrition to you.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think in America in general, there's this idea that you need meat for protein. We're so protein obsessed. And there's this lack of knowledge that protein actually exists within fruits and vegetables. So yeah, meat was on in every meal. There was bacon for breakfast and then, you know, chicken and the salads that I would get at work. And then for dinner, you know, it's just a meat palooza.
So did she worried about you when you said maybe you were gonna do something different?
Yeah, she's a nurse and, you know, it just, the idea of removing meat from my diet completely just went against everything she had been taught in her medical training in terms of the nutrients that I would need in order to sustain a healthy life.
The food writer Michael Pollan talks about eating as a chance to express our values three times a day. Before you changed your diet, what values did you think your meals were communicating?
No values. I don't think my meals were communicating any morals or values that I had. I was just completely unconscious when I was eating. I was eating based on, I was kind of letting my taste buds drive me in my food instead of sitting back and saying, well, how does this food make me feel? Where is this food coming from? You know, what are the implications of this food for myself and others? Instead, I was just kind of guzzling whatever I wanted whenever I wanted. So yeah, it was really low vibe eating.
So to be fair to you back then and to lots of other Americans, I mean, isn't it true that not everybody has the bandwidth to be thinking in a really careful way about what and how they're eating every meal?
I mean, I would argue that food is the most important thing as a human here on this physical earth. So if you don't have the bandwidth, then you should start to incorporate that. And there are a lot of ways that you can do that, even if, you know, you're low income.
So what made you decide you would try living without eating meat?
You know, I think living in this society, a lot of people are not strangers to having various different health ailments that they're dealing with, whether it's something serious like cancer scares or cancer, or you know, smaller things like gut issues or indigestion. So I was just going through that kind of roller coaster of experiencing things in my body. And I was led on the path to, like, you know, when I watched that episode of Michael Pollan and Oprah, it kind of opened my eyes to the fact that, okay, my food probably has something to do with the way that my body is physically feeling. So why not switch up some things and see what happens?
So you moved toward veganism gradually? How did you get started?
Yeah, it was very gradually. After I saw that episode, I bought Michael Pollan's book, Food Rules, and I just took like maybe 5 rules that resonated with me. One was like, don't eat anything that has more than 5 ingredients. So I just became very conscious about the types of food that I was bringing to my home. And I slowly started easing out of meat. I would do like 2 days a week where I wouldn't eat meat. And then my body started resonating to that. And then I slowly just started increasing that. And that took probably like over the course of like 2 years, that from when I started being conscious about food to when I finally cut meat out for good.
Was there a point at which you started thinking about yourself as a vegan, as opposed to thinking about being a person eating a vegan diet?
Yeah. The crossover happened for me just when I found myself explaining my diet to people. I was really resistant to the term vegan because I just felt like it didn't fit what I was doing. I had this idea of vegans as, you know, wealthy, white, stay-at-home moms who were going to yoga classes while I was like at work toiling away. And so I just felt like I'm not a vegan. I'm just slowly removing meat out of my diet. But then I would say it was about, yeah, like 2 years into my journey where I kind of adopted vegan just to explain to people what I was doing. And then I later learned to take pride in that word.
Where do you think the stereotypes come from that vegans are wealthy white ladies who are not working?
Yeah, I think it comes from just like marketing, the messages that were fed through the media. I work in media, so I'm really close to those images. And I mean, you know, veganism started becoming trendy within the last 10 years. It started really niche, and it's growing and growing and growing. And I think the consumer industry just kind of took over that messaging. You know, you'll see certain products or even certain companies, like food companies, like, let's say, you know, all the different salad companies like Sweetgreen or something like that. When they were first marketed to people, they just didn't seem very accessible. Like, it seemed like they were talking to a very specific type of person, and I didn't feel like I fit that person.
So, I mean, everybody thinks about things before they start them. Before you went down this path, when you thought about being a vegan, what concerns did you have? Like, what did you think might be an obstacle?
That's a good question. And concerns in terms of...
Well, you write in the piece, you know, you grew up with, you know, some of your favorite foods contained meat. Were you afraid you wouldn't have those anymore?
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, the family aspect was a big concern for me just because a lot of our get-togethers, our hangouts, even our, like, really small, like, you know, we're just, like, randomly gathering for something revolves around food. So I was very concerned that I wouldn't be able to participate, that I wouldn't feel included, that, you know, I would start to ostracize myself from my own family. And that is essentially what started happening.
Mm. But then your grandmother, of all people, gave you a cookbook that sounds like it helped to change your life. What was that book?
Yeah, it was Afro Vegan by Bryant Terry.
Tell us about the book.
Yeah, so he explores vegan recipes that are rooted in Black American, Southern cuisine, African cuisine, and Caribbean cuisine. So there are all these recipes that I, or all these food profiles that I was super familiar with already. And he just basically removed meat from it, which sounds simple, but it just allowed me to completely rethink my lens of what vegan food could look like and what it could taste like. You know, up until that point, my idea of vegan food was tofu. And I wasn't a tofu fan. So it was just kind of like, okay, I have to, like, eating plant-based felt hard. So when I was going to those family events, like, it felt difficult. But when I got that book, I started to understand that, oh, I can actually have fun and I can make things that taste good. I can make things that I'm kind of used to. So that was a game changer for me.
You also, it sounds like, started to realize there were a lot of other Black people eating plant-based diets. They may not have fit the profile of who's a vegan, but they were out there.
I'm sorry, can you repeat that?
You started to realize that there were a lot of other Black people in America eating plant-based diets who maybe weren't reflected in media coverage of people eating vegetarian and vegan diets.
Yeah, I mean, it's not something, well, actually it is, being vegan is something that people go around and shout about all the time. But it wasn't initially visible to me. So once I started doing my research, I saw people like Venus Williams and Cory Booker, who was the former mayor of Newark, and Kyrie Irving, and all of these people have a really strong presence in the Black community. So it was surprising to find out that they were vegan, because I felt like they weren't talking about it enough.
Why do you think the wellness industry, as it's sometimes called, has overlooked vegans who are not white? It seems like, what a great, you know, they're looking to make money. Like, why ignore this segment of the population?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think it just falls in line with the general idea of American history, where a lot of stories and histories of people of color are just erased from the narrative, and you know, white people are focused in the mainstream. So I think it has a lot to do with the capitalist culture that's here, in terms of who's gonna be buying these products. And if you're marketing toward a certain group of people, then you're gonna use images and stories that reflect those people. And then, you know, indigenous people will get erased from that story.
So you note that you didn't start exploring plant-based eating for any political reason, but because you're a Black woman, any choice you make around your identity is political regardless. Will you tell us about that?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like just anytime I speak about what I'm doing as a Black woman, it has a political undertone when I'm really just speaking about my experience. And, you know, I understood that plant-based eating already goes against the grain of mainstream food culture in America. And then you're adding on top of that, that I'm a Black woman who's very vocal about the health benefits and the cultural and spiritual benefits of plant-based eating. I automatically understand that I'm making a political statement just looking at my forebears and the way that they would talk about things that were considered radical at the time. I think plant-based eating is losing its radical nature, but it's still pretty out there. So I understand that people are going to attach a political nature to what I'm saying.
My guest is culture writer and editor Amira Mercer. Her article for Eater about the history of vegetarian and vegan eating in Black culture is called A Homecoming.
so I found this video of me from the beginning of quarantine making what looks like a stale donut pound cake milkshake type concoction. This is from a whirlwind tour and year, and after being 7 years vegetarian, going back to eating all animal products. And this is me now making my vegan protein shake. Honestly, I am both of these women, and I cannot condemn one woman or the other. I'm happy both ways. And right now, this is what's bringing me joy.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. That was singer Lizzo on TikTok marking 6 months of having been vegan. I think that happened in October of last year. My guest this hour is culture writer and editor Amira Mercer. She's founder of a wellness guide for Black women called Other Sons. And she wrote an interesting article for Eater recently about the history of vegetarian and vegan eating in Black culture. That article is called A Homecoming. If you want to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. So, Amira, when you started to realize you were a vegan, full on, did you have a sort of coming out about this to friends and family? And what was their response once it was clear that this wasn't something you were experimenting with, this was something you wanted to commit to?
Right. So I did kind of have like a coming out ceremony in terms of I officially crossed over when I did a 30-day juice cleanse where I only consumed fruit juices for 30 days. And that is what kind of solidified my relationship with my body and the fact that I was only going to eat plants for the rest of my life. And it seemed really radical to my family and friends. And it was a hard pill for them to swallow just because I did lose weight at first as I was detoxing. And I wasn't participating in the food rituals of our gatherings. I wasn't, you know, eating the same things that they were eating. I was bringing my own food to the family functions. And so it was definitely jarring to them.
Has anybody come around seeing that you feel good, you look good?
Right. You know, people are slowly coming. I've learned that everyone has to go at their own pace. People are slowly coming around. My mom she's a juicer now. She juices every day. She hasn't done a cleanse, but she juices and she definitely incorporates a lot more plant-based meals into her diet. I have a few cousins who are interested in going plant-based. So everyone's coming to me for advice, which is really cool. And I'm just like, yeah, I'm going to convert all of you guys.
So you have chosen a raw alkaline vegan diet for yourself. Can you explain what that means?
So that means that I consume mostly raw fruits and vegetables. I don't cook them. So you can think of that as just like a salad. And then I eat sprouted grains. So wild rice is a grain that you can sprout by just putting in water versus white rice. You have to cook it with heat on a stove. So, you know, a lot of juices, a lot of smoothies, a lot of coconut milk smoothies, which are delicious, a lot of fruits, a lot of vegetables, things that are already cooked by the sun. As the master chef Iris Latham says, sun-kissed foods, so things that are already cooked by the sun and you don't need to add extra heat to them.
So what are the origins of this approach to eating?
Yeah, well, I should also add, so the alkaline diet, the other aspect of that is that you're eating things that promote alkalinity in the body and reduce your acidity in the body. And I was introduced to that way of eating from Dr. Sabi, who was an herbalist who practiced from the 80s up until his death in 2016. And he was just really big on, it wasn't even about necessarily you have to eat these alkaline things. It was about getting Black people back on track with eating how their ancestors did. And in order to do that, you are eating mostly alkaline things. Most fruits and vegetables are alkaline, but his list really just narrows in on certain fruits and vegetables because of the nature of the food industry here in the US. He was aware of the chemicals and things that happened behind the scenes. So he created a really targeted list of fruits and vegetables and grains and herbs that promote the highest chances of alkalinity in the body for healing.
So can you give us an example of alkaline versus non-alkaline fruits or vegetables? I don't need an exhaustive list. I'm just kind of, I want to make sure I understand.
Yeah. So an alkaline fruit would be like an avocado. It's really, you know, has really healthy fat. There's a lot, you know, there's just a lot of good things going on when you eat it. A non-alkaline fruit, a non-alkaline produce would be something like a sweet potato. It's been, a sweet potato is a hybrid. So that's the best way that you can figure out the difference. Alkaline foods are natural. They haven't really been tampered with by humans. Non-alkaline fruits and vegetables are unnatural. So they've been hybrid, genetically engineered, genetically modified. A sweet potato, it has a lot of starch content, which isn't good for the body. So that's one of the another reason why it's not on the alkaline list.
Okay. You write here about a Eurocentric view of nutrition that is prevalent among dietitians. Can you tell us about like how that plays out when somebody visits a dietitian for guidance on the, you know, the right way to prepare and consume food?
Yeah, I think the Eurocentric view gets caught up a lot of times in numbers. So calories and, you know, different numbers in the food that I honestly don't pay attention to. I listen to my body intuitively and figure out what are the things that are promoting healing within me and what are the things that are promoting illness in me. And I stay away from those. A non-Eurocentric point of view towards nutrition is very intuitive. It's more holistic. It's focused on, okay, what is locally available to you? What are the food customs of your ancestors or your family? What works into your everyday schedule and diet? So it's a lot more intuitive centered versus numbers centric, because numbers can be misleading.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, some of this advice can completely overlook digestive issues that are more common among people of color than Americans of European descent, and telegraph that, like, if those foods don't work for you, the problem is your body rather than the foods themselves.
Yeah. I feel like with that view, a lot of diet plans aren't necessarily tailored toward the individual. And most people of color are lactose intolerant. So if you have diet plans that still include dairy for calcium, it's completely outdated in terms of how Black people should be eating.
What have you learned about how East Africans ate before they were kidnapped and dragged to the New World to serve as slaves?
I mean, indigenous people in general, whether they came from Africa or whether they came from America, ate mostly vegetarian diets. A lot of yams, a lot of peas, greens, you know, things that grow from the ground and from trees. And when they did eat meat, it was sparingly. It was very conscious. It was during specific seasons when the conditions were right to harvest that meat, or it was used to like help season food, but it was never consumed in this really gluttonous way that we see today.
Like a big slab of steak thrown on a plate was not the way of doing things.
Right. You might have, if you killed one cattle or one animal, it would feed a whole village and everyone would share. So it was very conscious, and you weren't overindulging in meat.
Okay. So how did enslavement change the foods available to Black people in America and the foods they had experience cooking?
Yeah, I mean, it completely took away our agency so that we were no longer in control of what we were eating. And slavery was a capitalist endeavor. So now you have plantation owners or slavers who are trying to turn a profit. So they're going to feed the people that they've enslaved with the cheapest options available. And at that time, it was the things that they discarded from their meals. So you have, you know, the discarded remains of the pig, and you have cornmeal, which was really cheap. And, you know, you couldn't necessarily, they wouldn't want enslaved people to grow their own food, because then that's taking away from the time that those people would be out working in the fields, creating profit for them. So that's where you see the emergence of things like chitlins and hog mogs that became Black food staples, all based off of this kind of survival way of eating.
So it's kind of extraordinary that people were able to take these foods that were considered cast-off products and make them taste so delicious. You also write that, you know, there were some enslaved people who were able to grow little garden plots to eat some of the foods maybe their ancestors had. But even that small bit of autonomy became harder. This is so interesting to me. As enslavement gave way to sharecropping, you would think it would go the other way around, but in fact it didn't.
Yeah, I mean, the big factor in that was we were supposed to get 40 acres in the mule, excuse mm-hmm. me. So after the war, after the Civil War, the Black farmers who had worked that land were supposed to get that land back in order to grow their own food. But instead, that land was given back to the plantation owners. And so that, you know, not having those reparations, which people are still asking for today, it has created this huge gap between Black Americans and white Americans, because Black people in the South were, after the war, were not able to provide for themselves in an independent and autonomous way. And so they had all the knowledge and all the know-how of how to work the land and what to do with those foods, but they were restricted to these sharecropping agreements with the white plantation owners that they had previously worked for or been enslaved under. So it completely changed their dynamic with food.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. What changed as so many Black families moved north during the Great Migration? What changed with regard to the way people ate and the time they had for cooking, that sort of thing?
Yeah, well, once families started moving north, their access to land for growing their own food and being autonomous was completely disrupted. And Black families became even more reliant in the cities on other people to provide food for them. But instead of going to another farmer to get their food, now they were going to supermarkets and corner stores and butchers and all these places that were already removed from, you know, fresh homegrown foods. And so that kind of changed the nature of food from produce to canned goods and meat and processed foods.
Why did meat become such a major source of calories throughout this country after World War II?
Meat became a scarce item during the war. So once it was over, it kind of became this luxury status symbol. And in Black Americans' desire to be seen as equals and to be seen as the same as white people, they adopted that idea of having meat as a table as a symbol of success.
So one way that plant-based eating did persist in Black communities was through the influence of religious groups. Will you tell us about some of those groups?
Yeah, so the Rastafarians were and still are really big on Ital eating, which is all about eating things that bring you closer to God. So they eat, most Rastafarians eat mostly vegan diets because if their belief is that if you're killing an animal in order to eat, then that takes you further away from God. And probably the most radical religious group at that time in terms of connecting the food that we eat with the oppressive system that we live under was the Nation of Islam. And its leader at the time, Elijah Muhammad, he actually wrote two books called How to Live on how Black Muslims should eat in order to not only secure their spiritual welfare, but to secure their physical welfare and their political welfare, and to be able to move under a racist system while expressing their highest self.
What ideas about food were reflected in the Black Panthers' nutrition programs for school children?
Just in terms of being able to feed the community and providing access to nutritious foods as an underlying way to combat racist oppression. They noticed that a lot of families weren't able to feed their children. And so they created like the school breakfast programs that the government later adapted and were able to put nutritious food on the table for Black children.
My guest is Amira Mercer. She's a culture writer and editor and founder of a wellness guide for Black women called Other Sons. Her recent article for Eater about the history of plant-based eating in Black culture is called A Homecoming. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
Personal note, veganism means a healthier life, a happier life, a cruelty-free life. I used to think of veganism, when I would hear about it, I would say, oh, people who do that, honest to God, truth, I thought only white people did it. I was like, I had never met another Black vegan. When I was younger, I would hear about it and be like.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. That was actress and vegan food influencer Tabitha Brown. My guest this hour is Amira Mercer. She is a culture writer and editor, founder of a wellness guide for Black women called Other Sons. She wrote an interesting article for Eater recently about the history of plant-based eating in Black culture. That article is called A Homecoming. I did not know that Dick Gregory, in addition to being an activist and a comedian, he was like what today we would call an influencer with regard to diet. What sort of case did he make for vegetarian eating?
Oh, man. I mean, he completely made it holistic in terms of connecting the food that we eat to the racist, sexist system that we operate under. He was a big proponent of fasting as well. So as I juice fast, I pay homage to his legacy, but he, I think it was the Vietnam War that he said he wasn't going to eat any solid foods until peace was declared, and he ended up juice cleansing or juice fasting for like 2 years. Wow. Because he didn't realize it would take that long when he made that statement. So he was definitely very radical in terms of aligning his morals around food with the oppression that consumers and people face.
Is there a special role for celebrities to play? I mean, we always want to be careful about, you know, taking advice, from people who may not be traditionally qualified. On the other hand, you know, when a famous person that we really like says something, we're inclined to pay attention.
Right. I mean, I do think celebrities have a duty and a responsibility to use their platforms for good, for the collective good. So whatever that looks like for that person, I think it's absolutely their responsibility. We as consumers, as fans, as, you know, regular people, we have to use our discernment and, of course, do our research and listen to our intuition in terms of what's best for us. But I think, you know, someone like Dick Gregory, he used his platform to the max, and I'm super grateful for that.
So there is a lot of really exciting and creative work happening right now at the hands of Black vegan chefs and restaurateurs. What sway are they having on what all American vegans are eating these days, and maybe by extension, what everybody's eating?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, in Black culture, we're always praised for our innovation, for our ability to take, to make something from nothing. And so you are seeing that concept happening in the vegan industry. A lot of restaurants like Kepra's Soul Food, Kepra's Raw Food Juice Bar in DC, in Washington, DC, you know, he's creating vegan soul food that's completely not cooked. And so you're seeing it in this introduction of flavors and ideas into vegan food that's not just, you know, like salted tofu. It's really exciting.
It sounds really interesting. Like, give us an example of something like vegan soul food that is not cooked. That sounds really different from sort of traditional soul food as it's been defined.
Yeah, I mean, so one of his dishes is, it's a coconut crab sandwich. Mm. And it's made from coconut meat. It's made from coconut meat, but it's seasoned like crab meat. So it has that seaweed taste, and it's really delicious. You know, it's not cooked. And it takes, you know, crab, especially in an area like Baltimore and D.C., crab is a big component of the Black diet here. So it's really cool to kind of have these like fake outs where you think it's something and it's actually something that's really, really good and nutritious for you.
How do you feel about like meat replacement products? I know some vegans want nothing to do with them, and some say, well, if it can, you know, follow my values but not contain animal products, then I'm all for it.
Yeah, I personally don't consume meat replacement products in terms of like what's traditionally marketed. Like in terms of if it's a super processed product, then I don't eat it. But I think it's good for people as they're transitioning from a meat eating diet to a vegan diet. I fully support it as long as you use it as that stepping stone and you don't get caught. Because there are a lot of junk food vegans who are not conscious eaters, even though they're vegan and even though they're plant-based, and they're just as unhealthy as a meat eater. I kind of feel like if you're gonna eat that meat replacement burger, you might as well just eat the real thing and just be conscious and grateful of the animal that was sacrificed for your nourishment. Hmm.
Has your relationship to the spices you cook with changed since you've removed animal products from your diet?
Yeah, I've had so much fun just experimenting with the different spices that I use in my cooking. I've definitely come to learn more about indigenous spices and wild herbs, you know, whether it's turmeric. Turmeric is something that I never used in my cooking before, and now it's like a staple ingredient. Yeah, there's just, you know, chili powder, and tarragon is something that I got from Bryant Terry's cookbook. It's really good in like Caribbean food, but I think it came from Asia. You have to fact check me on that, but there are just so many different herbs and spices now that I incorporate into my food in order to make them kind of taste more like, you know, that meat savory element that you might miss sometimes.
Did it take you a while to find foods that would make sure that you got enough calories every day when you went vegan initially?
It took me a while to figure out how to eat for sure. In terms of the high caloric food, I mean, those things are right in front of us, like coconuts, avocados, but these are things that you don't necessarily know how to incorporate into an actual dish. So it took me a while to figure out how to actually eat those foods and how to make sure that I was getting enough of those foods. Because if you're eating a raw alkaline diet like I am, you do need to make sure that you're consuming enough food so that you're full.
Yeah, I'm also curious if you want to go out with friends and they have chosen, like, will they always choose a restaurant where you can find something that you can eat? Or do you sometimes have to, like, snack before you get there and eat when you get home?
I definitely have to snack, bring my own food. My partner and I, we're always bringing our own food if we're invited out somewhere. When I was living in New York, a friend of mine came to visit from Los Angeles, and you know, she wanted to eat, and I understand that New York is a restaurant culture. So I met up with her at a Thai restaurant, and I just kind of sat across from her and didn't eat. And she was so uncomfortable, and I was like, "No, it's totally fine. Like, I'm gonna eat afterwards." But yeah, it's difficult, but it's getting better. There's a lot of restaurants that are now taking into consideration that not all plant-based eaters eat cooked food. So you're starting to see more raw options on the menu, and you're starting to see a lot more things that I can eat. So it's cool.
I haven't been to a restaurant now, like most of us, in, you know, a year. But before that time, I was surprised at the kinds of restaurants that at least offer a few vegan dishes, even if it's not what they're known for.
Yeah, we're taking over.
So what sort of culture is there online? What kinds of communications are vegans and Black vegans specifically having with one another to share recipes and ways to interpret foods you might have grown up with that, you know, contain ingredients that you wouldn't use today?
I think, you know, as Black people are easing into plant-based eating, there's just a learning curve that's happening. And so the internet is providing a way for all of us to teach each other, because these are things that haven't been taught to us by, you know, even by our elders, and it hasn't been taught to us in the schools that we went to. So we're having to kind of teach each other, do our research, look to OGs like Dr. Sabi and Dick Gregory and Alvania Fulton and research their histories online and figure out how to make that work. So you're seeing a lot of you know, different social media accounts. My partner, he's the Alkaline Wave on Instagram. He's kind of leading the charge here in Baltimore in terms of we both are, in terms of helping Black people eat more in alignment with our ancestors. And there's just a big community of people who are wanting to learn, and the internet is just becoming one of the best places for us to connect and share information.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. It sounds like you hear from a lot of people who are curious, who want to try this. Does this kind of work also attract trolls? Do you have to watch out for those guys?
You know, when you eat like this, you're in alignment. And I really don't get a lot of hate or trolls coming my way. I think my energy is it just blocks them out. But I definitely get a lot more people who are just don't understand plant-based eating, and they have a lot of questions, and they don't understand, you know, why it's important to eat this way. They don't understand how, you know, their physical body needs to be nourished in order for them to be agents of good for the collective out in the world. You know, you can't move through the world with a sick body. It makes it really difficult to do the work that you would want to do on a mental, emotional, spiritual level. So I'm enjoying helping to educate people on why we need to focus on our food and make food an important, you know, spiritual practice almost.
When you are really, you know, sort of expressing your values through food, as we discussed earlier, and trying to make sure that you're really mindful about everything you put in your body, I wonder what other aspects of your life change. Do you think, you know, like, I'm not going to eat so well and then, you know, skip working out today? Or I wonder just what else changes for you?
What comes with plant-based eating, especially the commitment that I've made, is that you inherit. Can you still hear me?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm sorry, my computer went to sleep.
I'm glad you're still with us.
Oh my goodness, yeah. So there's a level of discipline that I've picked up eating this way. So, and that definitely spills out into other areas of my life. You know, I'm way more dedicated in my yoga practice. I'm way more dedicated in terms of healing myself. Once I started eating plant-based, I understood how much more work I had to do in order to kind of heal all the other aspects of my life. I was healing my physical, and I was able to start healing my mental, my emotional, my spiritual. So, you know, plant-based eating really is a foundation, especially for the Black community, because it's rooted in the way that our ancestors ate, and it impacts all areas of your life. It's very truly holistic.
So you are a vegan, which is to say someone who does not eat any animal products, but you use the phrase plant-based eating a lot. Does that suggest that you recognize that there may be people that don't want to sort of do all or nothing, but might be willing or able to eat less animal food and more plants?
Yeah, I mean, I think it kind of comes back to, like, I might still have a little bit of a bias toward the word vegan, just because when people use it, I know other people still have a certain idea in their mind of what a vegan is. So I use plant-based eating, like you said, to make it more accessible to people, and to help people understand that they can ease into it. You can start by just increasing the amount of plants that you're eating throughout the day. And if you're still eating meat, you know, just listen to your body. What I like to use a lot also is conscious eating, because I know that everyone is different. So I think if you're just consciously in tune with your morals, your values, your body, that will guide you on the right way to go toward eating. And it just so happens that many of the Black people that I'm in conversation with, once they become conscious eaters, they become vegans.
Amira Mercer is a culture writer and editor and founder of a wellness guide for Black women called Other Sons. Her article for Eater is called A Homecoming. Amira, it's been really interesting. Thank you for spending this hour with us.
Thank you so much, Chris.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. The Think podcast is free. You can find it wherever you get podcasts just by searching for KERA Think, or catch up at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.